This week, something special and spicy. It's the book review's sex issue. Francine Prose and Anna Holmes are here to talk about the most erotic books they've ever read.
Wifey was much more salacious than Forever and had descriptions of body parts and emanations.
Alison Wolfe talks about The XX Factor, her new book about what the economic rise of some women means for the rest of women.
You have these couples and you have well-paid professional women, and they have the money to pay other people to do things which our grandmothers did for nothing at home.
Julie Bosman joins us with notes from the field, and Gregory Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review with your host, the Book Review's editor, Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
This week, we have our sex issue, and on the back page for Bookends, Anna Holmes and Francine Prose both talk about the most erotic book they've ever read, and I will talk about mine as well. Anna, you wrote about Judy Blume's novel Forever.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like for our generation, it was either that or Wifey.
Yeah, or both.
Right.
I feel like you started with Forever and then you graduated to Wifey. Wifey was much more salacious than Forever and had descriptions of body parts and emanations. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on the podcast.
We're good.
That were much more scandalous than Forever. But Forever was the first time I had really read about sex. I mean, other than taking peeks at my parents' The Joy of Sex book. And I'm not even actually sure whether they had The Joy of Sex. It may have been a friend's parent.
Right. And how old were you when you read Forever?
I was about 12 years old. This was in 1985. It was the possession of my friend Rachel, who lived around the corner. And Rachel was much more mature than I was in many ways, developmentally, in terms of puberty. You know, I was very jealous of her. She had started menstruating. I hadn't. You know, she was kind of like my big sister, even though we were the same age. And somehow she had a copy of this book. She didn't have any older sisters. She had older brothers. But this book, you know, the copy she had was fairly worn. And I don't think it was worn because she'd read it so many times. I feel like someone had given it to her. So
Judy Blume, now you know why your sales weren't as like huge as they might otherwise have been, even though I'm sure that they were tremendous
for
those books.
Yeah. And, you know, I sort of knew what to expect with Judy Blume because she'd written about teenage sexuality in some of her books meant for younger readers, like Then Again, Maybe I Won't, which was about a young man who's hitting puberty and he has things like wet dreams and fantasies about his neighbor, or Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, which was really focused on that character's wishing for her period and for her breasts to start growing. But Forever was something that I felt that I had to hide, unlike the other two books. And so I took it from Rachel. I didn't steal it, but it was borrowed, and I snuck it home, which is to say I put it in a bag or a backpack, probably back then, and then hid it under my bed because I didn't want my parents to find it.
So you knew it was...
She had informed me before I even cracked it open that there was some naughty stuff in there, so I knew it was something to hide. And I mean, I don't think my parents were overly conservative. Certainly they were very socially liberal, but I think when it came to sex, they were a little uptight.
Like all parents?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I figured it was just mine. And I read the book maybe three times over the course of the maybe month that I had it before I gave it back. And of course, went back to the dirty parts, rereading it again, which I did about a month and a half ago before I wrote this column. I was surprised by how tame it really is. I didn't remember it as being that tame. I may have in my mind confused it somewhat with Wifey. At the time that I read it, I do remember feeling some uncomfortable feelings, squirming around a little bit. Just, you know, it was hot, for lack of a better word.
And those books were actually, you know, in the sort of strict category of the day, adult books.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't YA as we knew it.
I mean,
YA was sort of your Newbery winners, and there wasn't much else. You kind of went, at least in my experience, you went directly from, you know, Deanie to then V.C. Andrews and Sidney Sheldon and just sort of really very popular.
Yeah, there wasn't really a series of books, at least that I recall, that you went to after the age of, let's say, 11 that were meant for 12, 13, 14, 15-year-olds. I went straight to books by Stephen King, for example, or V.C. Andrews. But I feel like V.C. Andrews' books were, in a sense, YA, only because they were mostly read by teenagers. I don't think they were meant for teenagers.
They were
just
about incest.
Right. But I can't think of any adult that I know who read them as an adult.
Did you read V.C. Andrews?
No.
You skipped past that whole genre.
Yeah, it was like 70s TV. It was kind of not when I was paying attention.
Francine, you wrote about the Bible.
What you read before Judy Blume was published. I mean, I was trying to talk about the 50s when it was so hard to get sexual information of any kind, and the Bible was what there was. And you know, I could read it without worrying that anyone was going to find me, that it was a dirty book, because no one had the faintest idea, as far as I knew, that that's what I was reading it for. I mean, the thing I still can't figure out, and I was thinking about before I wrote the piece, was how I knew when the Bible was talking about sex, because it was so guarded. And, you know, the language
begat.
Of the King, the begat or new, or the language of the King James Version. And actually, a friend who I was talking to about the piece said, well, what about Onan spilled his seed on the ground? And I said, oh, I thought that was kind of like a gardening mistake.
Totally. Inch by inch. Well, I recall reading a book accidentally that turned out to be much sexier than I had supposed. And I think I was in fourth or fifth grade. I remember I used to go, my dad would take me to B. Dalton, and I would just kind of pile up books in tremendous stacks when he told me I could get one, because he would always relent and buy the whole thing, much to his part dismay, part joy. One of the books I recall was by Lisa Alter, called Other Women, and the cover, which is how I judged books at that time. I was, I think, in fifth grade, was a this sort of silhouette of a woman's back, also a popular theme today on book covers. And it's the nape of the neck or the back.
Yeah.
And I sort of got into it when I realized it was a lesbian love story. This was, you know, I don't want to say how long ago it was, but it was long ago enough that was incredibly scandalous. And I remember handing it over to my mother, and I remember saying, I don't think that this book is for me. It was probably a mistake, because I think a year later, I was reading Wired, the Jim Belushi story, and I knew exactly what I was reading. And she took it away. I thought I had sort of gained some credibility by turning over the sexy book. But that was the one book my mother ever took away from me, was the Jim Belushi
story. Did she think you were going to develop a coke habit by
association? No, you know, and that was during my obsessive reading about drug addicts of all kinds, as one will do. I don't know. But it was, I guess, a different kind of scandalous.
Well, that would be a whole other topic, which is, what would be the first book you got busted for reading?
Well, what was the first book you got busted for?
You know, I can remember it was Breakfast at Tiffany's. Now, I haven't read it in a while, but I don't remember any actual sex in Breakfast at Tiffany's. I mean, I think my father read it, and I was eighth grade or something. He went, what is this? What are you reading? You shouldn't be reading. So I think it was just what you would call lifestyle issues that made him nervous. But
Prostitution. But, you know, I think that it's interesting because you realize when you have kids and also when you grow up and you think back to what you read or saw as a child, that everybody, you absorb sort of what you're able to absorb at that time. Because I remember absolutely loving the movie Death Trap. Do you remember the movie Death Trap?
No.
It was Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve. And it was this great whodunit. And the two of them played lovers. I adored it. I saw it like 10 times. I then saw it as an adult and I realized they were gay. I had no idea. I just was not prepared for that information.
Yeah.
Well, I remember seeing Hans Christian Andersen, the Danny Kaye movie. It was one of my favorite movies as a kid. When I saw it as an adult, it was all full of these kind of insider gay jokes that never crossed my mind. You know, jokes about queens and so forth. And I went, what was I watching?
I often wonder whether kids who watched The Simpsons as kids, you know, then rewatch episodes later and realize how many inside jokes and how many kind of provocative things are going on in that animated show. On the topic of a book I got busted for, I can't think of a book that I got busted for because I tended to read books that were either in the library. I just can't think of one that my mother would have blanched at. I mean, maybe forever would have been it. And the books in our house were mostly nonfiction history books about the civil rights movement or the women's movement, or they were textbooks for my mother's education, you know, in graduate school and sociology. I mean, they're all kind of dry and boring to someone my age. And so I feel like the most salacious thing in my house was a book called The Family of Man, which is a famous book of photographs of human beings.
Right.
And there's some nudity and there's some sex depicted. But, you know, she left it out. I can't imagine that she had a problem right. with me looking at it.
Do you think that the way that children today encounter sexuality through literature has changed?
I suspect that they encounter it more in pictures, you know.
Online.
You know, yeah.
On TV,
yeah.
For sure.
I mean, I hate to sound like an old fogey, you know.
We're all old fogies here, Anna.
You know, think of the children. But I almost feel somewhat grateful that my introduction to sexuality, for lack of a better phrase, was through books and tamer pictures.
Right.
And by that, I mean the Playboys that my friends and I, you know, snuck looks at that were owned by the fathers, our fathers, not mine, their fathers or their older brothers, or the kind of college comedies that I make reference to in this piece that depicted naked women or sex. And, you know, and I have problems with a lot of the ways in which women are depicted in those movies. But that was certainly a more tame way for me to be introduced to the idea of naked people getting together.
See, I was such a nerdy little kid that when I saw those issues of Playboy that everyone else saw, I would just focus in on the handwriting. I always felt like Bunny and Missy and Tiffy. They always had this like perfect curly cute handwriting with like little hearts on top of their
eyes.
And they love tennis.
Right. Why don't I have handwriting like that?
Long walks on the beach.
We had books of art reproductions around the house. So, and that was my first introduction to naked people. So there was, you know, a Velasquez, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and it wasn't as if my parents were super prudish or modest, but somehow an actual naked person who I wasn't related to was just shocking and amazing and titillating.
And the at least the women depicted in a lot of, either in works of art and at least in maybe the nudie magazines or even the movies that I encountered in the 80s, tended to have more realistic looking bodies. I mean, I'm not saying they were realistic. They certainly fit within a certain ideal, but they were more realistic than I think a lot of the naked women that kids.
They may have actually even been real.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of them did not have, let's say, breast implants. I think that there was a recognition that women do have body hair and it doesn't need to be removed in its entirety. So that's, you know, when I do this kind of think of the children, I do worry about the depictions of sexuality, particularly female sexuality, that kids encounter, and I don't think that. I'm not a reader of a lot of YA or the sort of books that the teens would be reading that, you know, in which sex is depicted. But I have a feeling that the sex depicted in contemporary books that teens are reading is that these writers are not talking about breast implants and Brazilian waxes.
I think probably a lot of people are just grateful that their children are discovering sex through literature rather than somewhere else.
Or doing anything through literature.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. No, I think what scares me is that what they're seeing on TV and is that you can't have sex unless you're severely underweight because nobody does. Mm-hmm. You know, you never see a person with a normal body having sex in a movie or a TV show.
Girls, so, you see it in girls.
The girls.
Yeah.
And they're all watching that instead of reading books. Yay. Thank you, Francine and Anna.
Thanks for having us.
That was Anna Holmes and Francine Prose talking about this week's Bookends column, which asks, what's the most erotic book you've ever read? You can go online to www.nytimes.com/books and tell us about your first illicit reading experience.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is the late Tom Clancy's most recent novel, Threat Vector. That's Threat Vector by Tom Clancy and Mark Greene, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
What's going on out there?
Well, one of the masters of the military thriller, and what some might say was the inventor of the entire genre of military thrillers, died this week. Tom Clancy, of course, the author of The Hunt for Red October, Patriot Games, Some of All Fears, a very prolific writer and someone who sold more than 100 million copies of his novels, died this week in Baltimore after a short illness, and he was only 66 years old.
Julie, you wrote the obituary, of course, for The Times, and there were a few bits in there that were really interesting. One, that while he ended up with Putnam, a major publisher, he began with the Naval Institute Press. How did he get discovered?
This is a great story. Tom Clancy grew up in Baltimore, born to a very middle-class family. He went to Loyola University in Baltimore, majored in English, and married, had kids, but he always wanted to be a writer. And he started working for an insurance agency that was owned by his wife's grandfather, but he still harbored his literary ambitions. So he wrote his first book, which was The Hunt for Red October, and submitted it unsolicited to a very tiny publisher called the Naval Institute Press in Annapolis. And an editor there, Deborah Grosvenor, loved the book. It was a Cold War tale set on a Soviet submarine, and Clancy had packed it with so many details, everything about the mechanics of the book, with so much detail on about weaponry and nuclear warfare. And she loved it, but went back to him and said, "Look, this is almost too complicated, too detailed. I think the reader is going to have a tough time following it. Can you make some cuts?" So he cut about 100 pages, revised the novel, and then the Naval Institute Press bought it for $5,000.
And an early fan was Ronald Reagan.
That's right. I think that Ronald Reagan was really responsible for getting this book off the ground. It probably would have been a bestseller anyway, but the publisher made sure that a friend of the Reagans had a copy of the book. That friend got a copy of the book into Ronald Reagan's hands, and he said that it was his kind of yarn and that he couldn't put it down. So the rest
is history. A blurb from Reagan will do that to a military thriller.
Indeed.
And he grew up reading Naval Academy manuals and wanted to be in the Navy himself.
He did. He always had ambitions to be in the military, but when he was in college and he talked to an Army recruiter, that recruiter took one look at his very thick eyeglasses and said, "Sorry, Sonny, this isn't going to work out." So that was the end of his military career. But even when he was a kid, he was obsessed with naval history. He would read journals and books that were really written for career military officers, for engineering experts. And, he always was into the topic. And that was really what informed his books. Of course, later, after he became a huge best-selling author, he had access to all kinds of, top military officials. He had lunch and dinner with them.
And the relationship went both ways, right? Because he designed there was a video game that was designed based on his books that was so realistic, the military actually used it for training purposes.
That's right. He actually had an incredible side career in video games. He started his own video game company, and I read that about 79 million copies of his video games were sold, which is a pretty astonishing number. And he started that in the 80s. So he was really very early on the video game front.
And his publishing career is not over yet, because there's another Tom Clancy novel that's due to be published in December.
That's right. There's a new book called Command Authority, which is expected to be published in December. Not sure if his publisher will decide to move up the publication of that book. But he still had, a very devoted audience. I think that, people who know his work very well say that Clancy, who was always on the conservative side, became more conservative over the years, and that the quality of his books kind of declined over the years as well. The Hunt for Red October is frequently cited as one of the greatest genre novels ever written. It really makes you feel like you're in that submarine with him.
And rhapsodic early reviews from the Times.
Absolutely. I think one of the criticisms of his books was that his heroes were almost a little too heroic, that, you know, the Americans were always the good guys. All of his men were, you know, upstanding individuals and faithful to their country and led their lives with very clear moral values. So,
what's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong with that, of course. But, you know, all of the Americans were paragons of courage and devotion to service and country. So, and he had a huge audience, you know, based on his, you know, he was a darling of conservative media. Rush Limbaugh had him on his show all the time. And I think he was the only author that he would really have on the show very frequently. So he definitely had a lot of appeal from the right.
All right. Well, sad news for his many fans, Tom Clancy, who died this week at 66. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
Alison Wolf is the author of The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. She joins us here now. Hi, Alison.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thank you so much for coming in. So you are entering into a debate which is currently raging in the States.
So I have discovered. You know, I'm not surprised that it's becoming a busy area, because one of the things that I say in the book is that our world has changed utterly and dramatically. And the way in which it has done so involves women. Mm-hmm. That there is a real gulf between our societies and those of any other in human history. And it's to do with the arrival of educated, professional, successful women.
Well, it's those women who in the States in the last year have dominated the debate here. Anne-Marie Slaughter, Sheryl Sandberg, obviously. You're a professor of public sector management in, mm-hmm. at King's College in London. So
yes.
How did you come to this, and how is your perspective different from theirs?
I came to it slightly backwards, because yes, I'm an academic and I work above all on education and the labor market and the way that education and universities have been amazingly good to women. We have become a society in which formal credentials are more and more important, and formal credentials are great for women because they get them, and then once you've got them, again, in a society which believes in equal access and equal opportunity, even if we don't always deliver, but we do believe that if you have the credentials, you are up there, you should be offered a chance. And so I became increasingly aware of this, but also aware of the fact that the group for whom this had been so fantastic was far from 100% of women. And I don't think of myself at all as being, you know, clearly I'm not a Sheryl Sandberg. The people at the very, very top fascinate us all. But what to me has really changed society is the fact that there are 70 million people who are female, professional, well-paid, living lives that 100 years ago women could not have dreamed about. And 70 million is a lot.
Right. Did you come at this from a British perspective? Were you looking at primarily at the UK, or is this global?
Totally global. That was the thing, again, which I think struck me so much. Once I started looking at the numbers, what was so interesting was how you got the same story everywhere. You got, in developed countries, the same story. So, for example, you have this very, very large and distinct group. And it isn't, as I said, just the CEOs, not just the amazing household names. It's 15, 20% of the population. And they are increasingly different from the other 80%.
We're talking about college-educated
professionals. College-educated
class.
Professionals. And when you look at the jobs held by college-educated professionals, they are actually 50-50 male-female across the Western world now. And that group is increasingly distinctive, both the men and the women. And so when I started looking at that, what really struck me was that the patterns in the US and the patterns in the UK and the patterns in Scandinavia and the patterns in Italy and France and Australia were amazingly similar. And also that what was really striking, too, was the emergence of this group at a much greater speed in the developing world. That, you know, there you've got again, millions of successful female professionals, whereas back in 1900, there weren't too many of us.
And you have a real argument here in the subtitle, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. How has the rise of working women created a far less equal world?
Essentially, we now have a group of women who pay other people to do the things that all women used to do. And so it used to be equal in a rather depressing fashion, in that essentially women, whether they were richer or poorer, stayed home, cooked the meals, looked after the kids, right, took the primary responsibility. What has happened is that as things have changed, the gulf between the top 15 to 20% of women and other women has grown enormously. I mean, inequality has increased much faster among women than among men. But what has also happened, and I don't want to imply this as the women's fault as opposed to the women's and the men's fault, is what you're getting is you're getting, if you like, a super class, super families. So they work very hard, they're very stressed, they don't have much leisure time. And so what has happened is that you've actually got the coming together of two successful careers all over the place. They therefore have spending power, which pulls them ahead. So, you know, clearly in some ways it's become more equal between genders at the top. But in other ways, it's tended to reinforce things that were happening for other reasons in the economy. And you have this large undergroup of predominantly women who are doing for pay things that my grandmother
right.
had to do for nothing.
So it's an inequality within the gender. It's an inequality between
which didn't exist
women.
Before. The area where I think that I've seen it most clearly is everybody's obsession, which is education. That we're all obsessed with our kids' education for good reason.
And because due to economic insecurity.
Due to economic insecurity, we feel it's a hard, tough, globalized, competitive world out there, and we kind of have to look after our kids. And so you have this terrifying competition, and I think New York has a particularly clear case of it.
Brutal.
But London does too. So we agonize in London over social mobility. And we agonize over social mobility, but at the same time, we are all killing ourselves to get our kids into the best schools. And in that sense, again, I think it's harder to come up than it
right.
was.
You talk about the increase in inequality. Who is this coming at the expense of?
It's coming at the expense of people at the bottom. You have these couples and you have well-paid professional women, and they have the money to pay other people to do things which our grandmothers did for nothing at home. And this has coincided with the opening up of borders. And there's now what somebody else very cleverly, not me, called a global care chain. So you actually have large numbers of people who are able and willing to travel large distances to do these jobs for very low wages. And so I think the group that has lost out most from this and from similar economic changes are the people in well-off developed countries who are not doing the top jobs.
Right.
So I think it's compounded something that's been happening in our globalized workforce anyway.
And you have the Filipinos, let's say, going to the Middle East, and then what happens to the families or the lives that they've left behind, too?
Well, they are left without a mother. And, you know, from their right. point of view, you could say that this is good news and that it means they send money back. But it's also, of course, very bad news for, let's take Filipinos going to Hong Kong. They will be large numbers there, and people in Hong Kong who might have actually been doing better jobs and having jobs at the bottom come up faster will do worse. All over Europe, what we found is that we have got really, really low wages among native-born people, and they just don't get jobs and they get squeezed out, and the conditions of work at the bottom are constantly under stress. And if you compare that with, say, the 1950s, when there were far more in the way of what people call breadwinner families,
yes. when,
then I think for those people, life is not obviously better. For them, they have actually lost out compared
right.
to people at the top.
But it's interesting because you talk about these super families and the fact that you have two partners who are both earning very good salaries. And yet, even at this high professional class, college-educated level, many of them are not necessarily doing it because it's a choice. They're doing it because they're in an economy in which it's absolutely necessary to have those two incomes.
I think nothing is ever a pure choice, and nothing ever feels like a pure choice. You make decisions in the context of the stresses that you're under. And it's not a choice if you want a fulfilling life and you want your children to do well. So at one level, of course, it can be a choice. You could decide that you were going to take a drop in income, take a drop in living right. standards, not get, send your kids to great schools, accept slipping backwards in a whole load of ways. But not many people would want to make that choice. If you want to live in a good area with good schools, send your kids to college, to good schools right. or college, if you want to have the sort of fulfilling career which women now can have, and if as a man, and this goes both ways, you actually want to marry somebody like you,
right.
And that's, I think, very interesting, that this has actually been good for men at the top as well. It hasn't actually been bad for them. They like educated women. So if you want all those things, and why wouldn't you, then you end up with a lifestyle which is in many ways very satisfying, but which is also pretty stressful.
Right.
And no, I don't think it doesn't really feel like a choice, but it doesn't feel like a choice because it's unimaginable that you wouldn't want these things.
Right. What I mean, one of the interesting things in America, and I don't know if this is reflected in the UK or if it's something that's global, but there is while there's a lot more marriage across religion lines of religion and race and ethnicity, that the lines of intermarriage between different classes has not changed at all.
It's absolutely the case in the UK and everywhere else. In fact, if anything, it's even more so. I mean, all the evidence is that actually people are less and less likely to marry across class and across education lines. That what academics call assortative mating, which sounds terrible, but it's kind of what human beings and chimpanzees and
right.
orangutans do.
So it's an increased sort of stratification.
It's actually increased.
Between...
And exactly. And that's, I think, again, one of the things that's sort of worrying, that all of this over time tends to make social mobility harder, not easier.
Right. Well, a lot of what you talk about in the book is universal or global, at least in the developed world. But your book came out in the UK a few months ago, and it's coming out now. In terms of the reception of the book so far, were there things that preoccupied your British readers or the media there that were different from what you're hearing here in the States?
I think I'd like to throw that back to you, because my impression is that in the US, there is much more of a tendency for people to feel strongly that they are feminists or not feminists, that this argument about I'm a feminist, I'm not a feminist, is much more live here. And therefore, that there is therefore one of the things I would sort of expect I might get is how can you say this? How can you imply that you're with that group that thinks feminism was a mistake? I think that in the UK, people basically accepted the argument at one level and were deeply uncomfortable with it at another.
What were they uncomfortable with?
I think they were very, very uncomfortable at the idea that anything that involved greater access for women to higher education, greater access for women to better jobs, might actually have this underbelly.
Presumably also, they're not totally obsessed with Sheryl Sandberg and Anne-Marie Slaughter. They haven't been necessarily reading the same arguments that have been so prominent in the media here, but perhaps it's Caitlin Moran or, I don't know how she does it. I don't know if there are other sort of touchstones.
Yeah,
of things.
It is interesting. I think Sheryl Sandberg has been big everywhere, but most of the others know that it's not the same. It's a different space. It's a different discussion. I think that basically in the UK at the moment, we are obsessed with social mobility. And this is a kind of a thing where for everybody who is quite privileged, it's a difficult issue because everybody wants social mobility except when it implies that their kids might be mobile downwards.
Right. The super people are happy to be there.
So I think that the things which people were very occupied with was this idea of super families. And I think, again, because even more than here, the UK is very London-centric. London at the moment has become this extraordinarily both international and wealthy place in the center with a periphery that seems to get poorer. And you have this sort of bizarre situation of apparently the economy growing and yet home people, home-born people who were born in Britain can't get jobs. And we have a lot of sort of immigration going
on. Well, New York City is nothing like that.
No, well, exactly. But New York City is exactly that,
yes.
Of course, which is why it always feels sort of not that far away when I come. But I don't know about the rest of the US. It may not feel quite so extreme, but certainly in London, it feels super extreme.
Right.
Everybody's obsessed with this, but not actually prepared to to sacrifice their own kids. So I think it was the sort of this idea of the super families and this being linked into this feeling we have that we've got a large group of British-born people of different colours, but all British-born, who somehow just cannot make it, we can't seem to break this. And I think there was a sort of a link there. The other thing, which I have to say everybody picked up on in Britain, was the sex stuff, the bit about nice girls don't till they get to university.
Well, since this is our sex issue, tell us more about that.
We actually have unusually good sex data in both the UK and the US. We're the two countries that actually have really, really good, reliable data on what people are doing.
We don't know anything about cancer or about...
We can't fix our medical systems, but we do know what people are doing, and mostly it's quite dull, actually. But there were two things. First of all, it was very interesting to find out that what everybody believes is true, that the sexual revolution started in the colleges and it spread out. But the other thing that was just really dramatic was this growing gulf between not just girls, but also guys who are heading for college and those who have, at the age of 14 or 15, essentially decided that they're never going to go to the Ivy League or Oxbridge. They're probably never going to go to a really good school. They're just, and what you're getting is, on the one hand, in one group, they're postponing sex. They are concentrating on their studies. They've got that goal in sight, and on the other, an ever earlier age for sexual activity.
So get ahead and don't have sex.
And then when you get have a good time when you're age 14 or 15, and then actually rather depressingly, by the time you're in your 30s, the college group seem to be enjoying it more.
We'll end on that jolly note then. Thank you so much. That was Alison Wolf. Her new book is The XX Factor: How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. Thanks, Alison.
Thank you very much.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What is new on the list this week?
I thought this week I would look at the combined lists, mainly because there's been so much turnover, especially on the fiction side of things, where over half of the list is new this week. This will give you a good sense of what people are looking at on their Kindles on the train next to you. Starting at number one, new at number one, Stephen King's follow-up to The Shining, Dr. Sleep. Makes its debut on the combined list and on the hardcover fiction list. That's new at number one. No real surprise there. Then at number three, Sandra Brown has a new book called Deadline. Then new on the combined list at number five, Jhumpa Lahiri has a new book, a new novel out. It's her second novel called The Lowland.
Now, did her previous books hit the bestseller list?
They did. Her first book did not, but it did something maybe better, which is it won the Pulitzer Prize. And since then, she's been kind of a brand name. Her second story collection made its debut at number one.
Wow, that's very rare for short stories.
Exactly. And her previous novel, The Namesake, also was a bestseller for several weeks. Yeah, so she's no stranger to the list. Then new at number six, Christina Baker Klein has a book called Orphan Train, new at number six. What's interesting about this is that it first came out in April and it got good reviews in a lot of places, but didn't get a lot of commercial traction. The reason it's on the list now, as a lot of things are on the combined list, is that it was a Kindle Daily deal last month. Yep, that pushed it onto the list. Then at number eight, Abby Glines has a book called Simple Perfection. This is part of her Perfection series of romances. At number nine, Lindsay Sands, another series. This is a vampire series. The name of the book is One Lucky Vampire. It's part of her Argano vampire series. Then at number 12, another series romance, the Fool's Gold series by Susan Mallory. Susan Mallory is getting an early jump on Christmas with her latest title. It's called Christmas on 4th Street.
Yeah, I was still adjusting to the vampire in Halloween.
So Christmas is now on the list at number 12. And then at number 15, the last new title on the combined fiction list this week is by Jill Shalvis. It is another romance, and it's called Always on My Mind. On the nonfiction side of things, it's a little bit quieter. There are just two new titles on the combined lists, including the new number one title this week. It makes its debut. It's called Killing Jesus.
You know, you take that title out of context and...
This is by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard, who have lately made something of a killing on a series of books. They started with Killing Lincoln, then they moved on to Killing Kennedy. I guess they've had their fill of presidents now. And
who will they kill next?
So this time it's Jesus. It's kind of a historical narrative look. As much a fictional take. I mean, it goes through what we know of the history,
right,
much as Zealot does by Reza Aslan.
Two historical Jesus books on the bestseller
exactly
list
right.
this week.
Both written as kind of straightforward narratives. Yeah. Then at number 13, the other new nonfiction title on the combined list this week is by Eric Schlosser. It is Command and Control, which is a look at America's nuclear arsenal.
And he was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago talking about that.
Yes, he was.
Well, thank you so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.